This edition of Monocle on Sunday was first broadcast on the 31st of October 2021 at 10 a.m. CET. COP26, the UN Climate Change Summit, begins later today in Glasgow. More than 20,000 delegates from 200 countries will be there to announce how they will cut emissions by 2030. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the summit will be the world's moment of truth, but some are suggesting the summit lacks teeth, with the leaders of both Russia and China staying away. Japan is holding a general election today. It's being seen as critical in providing Fumio Kishida, the country's new leader, with the public mandate he says he needs. The ruling Liberal Democratic Party faces its biggest electoral challenge in almost a decade as it faces an ageing electorate that is weary of the COVID-19 pandemic. Saudi Arabia has ordered Lebanon's ambassador to leave by Sunday over insulting comments by a Lebanese minister. The Gulf Kingdom has also imposed a blanket ban on all imports from Lebanon. And shaking hands is back. A British polling company suggests that in a group of young people, all but one said they had gone back to shaking hands when meeting. The survey, published in the UK's Sunday Telegraph newspaper this morning, also reports on an evolutionary biologist who says our instincts to link hands and fingers after conflict can be traced back to our chimpanzee ancestors. And those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Now it's time to cross from a soaking wet London to a bright and sunny Zurich for this week's Monocle on Sunday. Our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, is standing by. Good morning, Tyler. Plenty of firm handshakes all round where you are, I hope.
There are, but I have to say good morning, Emma. But Ben O'Zog here is making faces. I don't know, he just didn't like the word chimpanzee or interlinked fingers, but we can be discussing that a little bit later, I think.
I want to know what's wrong with chimpanzee and interlinked fingers. Or we're going to find that out.
I think we'll wait till maybe sometime after 10:30 to find out a little bit more about that. Aside from soggy London, what else is happening over that way today?
All is well. It's incredibly soggy, so everyone's retreating indoors, looking at what's happening in COP and trying not to give it too much attention, and lots and lots and lots of trick or treating. So I shall be asking Chandra for advice as to what to drink through which mask later on this afternoon. In fact, any costume advice would go, frankly, very, very down very well down here in London.
Okay, well, Chandra's just got her like sort of blank, dumbfounded face about that. But anyway, we're going to perk things up, and we'll be talking to you in 27 minutes. Monocle on Sunday starts now. Good morning from Zurich. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, my guests today, Ben O'Zog, Nina Kunz and Chandra Kurt. They're all here to talk about the weekend's biggest stories. Benno, you're right here. What's caught your eye?
Well, no doubt the weekend was all about major summits, international summits. We're talking about COP26 as well as the G20 summit. It's unavoidable. But also another lighter story, I guess. Prices in the UK for sparkling wine are going down, but for your breakfast are going up. Curious.
Okay, well, Chandra can also help dissect that as well. We're also heading over to Thailand to hear from our correspondent over there.
I'm Gwen Robinson in Bangkok, and I'm going to be telling you about Thailand's grand reopening after a long lockdown.
Also, we'll be talking to Christoph Ahmen from Zeit magazine. He'll be telling us what's making headlines in his part of the world. It's the 31st of October 2021. Happy Halloween. Live from Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday with Tyler Brulé.
And good morning, as we said, from a very, very sunny Zurich. It's a bit damp, wet leaves all over the street. But aside from that, it looks like a very, very promising day. You might have heard in the intro, ladies and gentlemen, that, of course, there's news out of the UK. Of course, that people are shaking hands, which is good news. But while we were reading that news report, Ben O'Zog, who is here this morning, of course, a regular voice, also our security correspondent, was making faces. Or were you making faces? I'm not sure what that was. Or you weren't buying it, Benno.
I was not making faces. That was an accusation. I quite like a good handshake, and I missed it during the pandemic. And you yourself, Tyler, have a very firm one. And if that goes back to the chimpanzees, it only makes it more natural to actually shake hands.
Good to hear. Chandra Kurt is also here this morning. Chandra, good morning.
Good morning, Tyler.
How are we today?
I'm sober. No, I'm good.
Does this sort of suggest a late evening or?
No, you know, now it's actually already 11 o'clock, so I feel my Bloody Mary pushing on Sunday lunchtime.
Okay, well, I'm looking across to Desiree over here, whether there is tomato juice in the bar this morning. We can see. But anyway, the branch of Kopitz Stadelhofen is not very far away. I'm very happy to say, you know, Emma at the start of the show said a lot of regular voices, trusted voices, but we have a new voice around the table here this morning. Nina Kunz is here. She's an author, she's a journalist, she's a columnist. She writes for Zeit magazine, the new Schweizer Ausgabe, also with the Tagesanzeiger. And it's, Ben, we saw this a little bit, there was sort of an escalation almost a bit earlier because there was the war of the books around the table a little bit, wasn't there? So Nina also has a new book out, Ich denk zu viel, I think a lot. Maybe we'll start by saying good morning.
Well, good morning and thank you so much for having me.
Not at all. Tell us a little bit about the book first.
Well, the book is called I Think Too Much, well, in English. It came out in March, and it has spent 30 weeks on the bestseller list in Switzerland, which is really overwhelming. I never thought this was going to happen. And it's about rumination, and it's a collection of 30 essays that deal with contemporary issues.
And this is, I was just saying before we went on air, this came out before the ruminating started, but well before the pandemic. It wasn't one of these titles. It was just rushed to press because you were having deep, deep thoughts starting in March of last year.
No, we were actually waiting to put it out because the bookstores were closed. Everything was very uncertain. And it was so great to go out with this book. And I kind of, the first 2 months were just Zoom readings. And then it was masked readings, and now it's real readings, and I see people and their faces, and it's marvelous.
Well, very good to have you. I'm also happy to say Andrew Tuck, our editor-in-chief, is, I think he's in the UK, I believe. I've heard rumors that he's heading, not to the COP summit, but he's heading another COP. He's heading to Copenhagen. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, Tali. I'm going there this evening at the end of the day, but yeah, I'm firmly in a very rain-lashed London this morning.
And tell us about Copenhagen. I believe that there's another type of summit which is on the cards.
Yes, slightly, I think, more modest in the numbers of people flying in for it. But it's a city's summit looking at the role of culture and big events in shaping how our cities become more livable. And also, they want an outside perspective on why Copenhagen continues to do so well in our livability indexes. So I'm going to talk about, you know, why we set that index up and what it means and how it's adapted over time as well.
Andrew, maybe just staying on the Glasgow theme as well, but also what you'll be talking about in Copenhagen as well, because it's interesting that we've been through almost a decade of people talking about, you know, the power of cities and, of course, what you can do at a grassroots level. But if you look north from where you are towards Glasgow, is, you know, we have Russia absent, of course, a rather significant player in all of this, even more significant China. So here we're dealing with things at a federal, national level. Do you think already, is there enough dialogue about what happens within an urban context, what happens outside of your front door, and the level of mobilization that needs to happen there? Or do you think, or is it a situation where people think, well, actually, we're already doing enough in daily life. We'd like to see things happening maybe more from the top end than at the bottom end?
Well, I'm not sure where everybody stands sometimes when these things happen. But I think what we've seen ever since the Paris talks, where you had a US administration that didn't want to get involved in debates about climate change, that what often happens is that the takeaways from these events get picked up much quicker by civic leaders, by your mayor, by your local authority, and put into action. So that happened in the US after the Paris talks, you know, that many very powerful leaders at a civic level said, look, we are going to meet these climate demands. We understand that this is a genuine crisis. And here in the UK, you see this tension between a city mayor like we have in London, who is determined to kind of go faster than what's happening at the national level. So we have a thing called here a ULEZ zone, which stops people really bringing in diesel cars now into the city. It benefits people who have newer cars. Now, there's rights and wrongs on all the sides of these arguments. But I think that will happen again here, that even in countries which may be seen to be a little bit laggard on these topics, you will find civic leaders, you know, even places like Russia and China, who will be determined to respond because they see the crisis happening in their actual cities.
Benno, if you look across to Glasgow as well, and maybe just we'll start with a sharper question in terms of outcomes. And by the time we get to the end of this, by the time things wrap, are we going to see quite a clear set of marching orders, or are we going to be sort of faced with another sort of protracted period? Of course, just figuring out what comes and how do you unravel what will be discussed and tabled in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm. We'll unlikely see any revolutions, but the good thing in a way is that we can go back to the 2015 Paris Agreement, which set very ambitious goals, and there is still this reference to the 1.5 degrees goal. Others talk of 2 degrees, we're probably heading towards 3 degrees currently, so we can't probably expect any breakthroughs for a variety of reasons. But even in previous months and years, some countries have come out, for example, Russia declaring they want to go net carbon neutral by 2060, which isn't overly ambitious, particularly given their strong industrial history, and now they do emit less anyway. But that's somewhat surprising. China named the same year, others go for 2050. So there is an increase in a way of setting goals, of setting targets, even if they're far in the future. So that's something one can build upon. And the UK, being the host of the summit, is actually kind of a leader on all of that in and of itself. Their energy mix is fairly low on carbohydrates. So that's a bit of a start, makes one somewhat optimistic. I guess part of the summit, same as the G20 that just concluded in Rome, was also just to reconnect after the pandemic, to be there in person. And that's a value in and of itself, because as we've seen in Rome just these days, meeting, shaking hands, having site meetings, not just digital, has its value and may help for countries to come to somewhat of an agreement and actually agree on certain things on which they wouldn't otherwise in a Zoom meeting, I guess.
Mm. Andrew, what else is making news this morning? Obviously, a lot of course, headlines at the end of last week about the Queen saying she's going to take off 2 weeks, or she's been ordered to take 2 weeks off, not going, of course, to Glasgow, which they said she was very much looking forward to. Is this part of what we'll be seeing at least on the front or the third page of the paper this morning?
Yeah, so if you want to dive into the tabloids, they're saying you that you can get every angle on the story. The poor Queen is being put under pressure because the likes of Harry have kind of fled to America. That Prince Andrew is caught up in some legal tussle. So that supposedly this has put added pressure on the Queen, and they're saying that the likes of Camilla are going to step forward to take some of the appointments would have fallen to her, or at least accompany her in the future if she does restart her diary. I don't think people are too worried about the Queen on the front pages today, but they are looking a bit at kind of Prince Charles and Camilla, because you can see that there is a sense that it might not be too long before they are in the key positions, and that old debate always flares up whether it should leap one generation and go to William and have a much younger monarch in power. But that's a topic, and of course this endless, annoying, stupid battle over fishing rights between France and the UK, where it seems that both Macron and Boris seem to think there are constituents that they have to appease, and their behaviour is extraordinary, and it's just so annoying. This thing can't be wound down ahead of COP.
I've got Chandra standing beside me. Chandra, maybe first, I mean, Nina's had a moment to talk about her book. Maybe your volume is much bigger than hers, I have to say. And I haven't even, I know there's also a lot more pictures as well, which is always nice in a book as well. But tell us about your new book.
Okay, it's called Reisen mit Wein. It's 21 journeys to 8 countries, to different wine places. And it happened also during this COVID year that I thought we cannot travel anymore. So, but we did in the Wine Cellar Journal, the magazine we produced, we always did big cover stories. So we took the cover stories together, modified them a bit. And of course, there's a lot of pictures, over 500 pictures, and we travel with the wine. So this is the title, Travel with Wine, with a bottle of wine, because behind every bottle, there's a story, there's a country, there's a person, there's a memory. So when you open a bottle anywhere, you travel. And when you look now at the book, you have all these beautiful images. And it just came out the other week, and we will have here, I think, soon an apéro. I think, when is it? On the 9th of November.
Yes, indeed.
Here in the studio.
So all of our listeners, if you want to get a ticket and secure a spot for the book, then please
we'll bring a lot of wine from all over the planet, and then you can really feel what it means to travel with wine.
Mm. Let's start with the maybe sort of the Halloween themed portion, or maybe it doesn't have to be Halloween themed. I mean, Andrew, you were just talking about obviously the fishing issues over in the UK at the moment. Is there fish that would be looking for a wine complement at the moment? Are the shelves reasonably stocked and looking robust at the moment?
I think that the fish counter seems to be doing okay. It's very funny all these shortages get talked up here in the UK, you know, and I think some of them are obviously genuine, but it's not actually impossible to feed yourself in Britain. You can still get your daily intake of calories, I assure you.
Okay, so give Chandra her brief, Andrew. It's a soggy Sunday. You don't have to consume this wine this evening, but go for it with what you need from Chandra.
Well, why don't we think big this week, Chandra? Tell me a wine that you think you could drink that maybe was a little bit more gentle on the planet in how it's made and how it's produced and the number of miles it travels. What would be your pick for a wine to serve to all the dignitaries turning up at the COP talks?
Perfect. You know, I love to think big, so we will find something.
Okay, Benno, over to you.
I'll describe my very setting actually tonight. We're cooking something along the lines of ratatouille or something similar-ish, and what wine would go with that? Ideally, it's a wine that I already have in my shelf somewhere, because that's a sustainable option, I think, and it also helps with bigger shelves.
This involves you inviting Chandra around to look at the shelf as well, and then establishing
gladly
from there. Only ratatouille?
We haven't really agreed on the rest of the menu.
Okay,
there'll be
right.
more.
There's time to work on it. Emma, over to you.
Very much a Halloween theme. Good morning, Chandra.
Good morning, Emma.
So two things, please. One, we have a glut of scooped out pumpkin in the fridge. So you can imagine what that's like. So we need something to perk that up a little bit. It will, I think, be turned into soup. It may go in the bin, but if it doesn't, please could we have something to drink with it? And secondly, there is a trick-or-treating trip out this evening. Something to go in the hip flask, please.
Oh, yes.
Okay, Nina, you're new to the gig here, but I think you understand how it works. So please tell Chandra what you're in the market for.
For wine? Wine-wise?
I mean, Chandra sometimes goes off-piste a little bit, but let's keep it to wine as a starter.
Okay, I like dry wine. That does not give me a headache. I'm not very picky.
Price?
Well,
I mean, you've been on the bestseller list for 30 weeks, so this assumes that we can think big as well.
Yeah, let's think big.
Good.
Very good. Andrew, just before we go, in case we don't catch you before the end of the program, a little bit of a Copenhagen. I'm sure it's going to put a spring in your step. I gave you a few little tips of places that you might want to venture out into, and maybe do wardrobe top up, or maybe a little maybe just to improve you know, the way the desktop looks, or whatever it may be. But as you sort of step out into the Nordic world, this is sort of one of your first trips that you've sort of done, not tethered to Zurich, not tethered to heading towards Palma. Little sense of excitement?
Yes, and also because I'm going to be on stage talking. I suddenly realized this morning it's quite a while since, outside of our events, I've done that, and then I'm on a panel as well. And I'm taking the opportunity, of course, to see our correspondent in the city and to see your friend of mine, Thomas Licke. And so it would just be good to kind of meet quite a few people on the ground and get their view of things. But yeah, I am. It's just good to go out again and start telling the story of Monocle and explaining to people what we've been up to.
Well, Andrew, have a really, really good time. I was sort of blazing the trail there for you last week. It feels absolutely fantastic and very perky and alive. That's our Andrew Tuck, our editor-in-chief back in London. Benno, maybe let's have a little look at the front pages. You teased us with a couple of stories. Have we done COP already, or do we need to spend more time in Glasgow, or do we want to move on? And maybe, I mean, Nina, you had one story out of The Economist as well. Maybe this can be the final word maybe this morning before we move on to some other topics.
Okay, I read so much on COP this week, and I try to find a good balance between devastating news and hopeful news. So I'm going to end with the optimism, because in the leading article in The Economist this week, they had kind of four reasons why the conditions for Glasgow are so much better than 6 years ago in Paris and 12 years ago in Copenhagen. And they said it's, first of all, heightened awareness. It's totally different. Then we do know that fossil taxes work and they're efficient. And there is just so much more research into renewable energy. And I'm going to read one sentence. They say, the main reason the COP process matters is that the science, diplomacy, activism and public opinion that support it make up the best mechanism the world currently has to help it come to terms with the fundamental truth. The dream of a planet of almost 8 billion people, all living in material comfort, will be unachievable if it is based upon an economy powered by coal, oil, and natural gas.
And your take on that, I mean, if you think about, and obviously we're touching on this, what happens at an urban level, at a city level, that this is oftentimes where you can get policy cut through. I mean, when you get to the end of the Economist's analysis, what is Nina Kuntz's take on this?
That it's very difficult, and that we don't only have to find a system where we do not have emissions, but also have investments and innovation to withdraw carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Mm.
Benno, I said this was final word, but on that, you sort of talked about maybe the prospects that would come out of this as well. Do you think we see something bigger emerge from this too? Because there seems to be also, how do you square a number of topics? Because, okay, let's say, if I really sort of feel committed to all of this, and then China does not, show up, what am I then also doing as a consumer? What is, what is my view about either buying a car made in China, as to whether or not I want to buy a sweatshirt made in China as well? Because this has, quite significant ramifications when someone is just, said, for obviously what is, of course, one of the most important headline events, really out of this last sort of 18-month, two-year cycle, we're not showing up.
I actually find this one of the most tricky issues when it comes to the whole climate and carbon challenge in and of itself, this gap between individual level behavior and collective behavior. We all know that certain states as a whole, certain companies like oil giants, for example, emit as much as dozens of millions of consumers emit. But so to find this balance between ourselves, obviously we try to recycle, we try to fly less, we try to take the train more, while at the same time trying to hold collectives, our own states, accountable, and hoping for others, where democratic ways don't work as well, follow suit. But I think one cannot be an excuse for the other, obviously, even if China's absent. Xi Jinping wasn't in Rome. He will not be in Glasgow. He will only attend virtually, from all I know. This doesn't mean that anyone else can be less committed. I sometimes try to think about it as a rich person, given a global average level as a Swiss, I myself am responsible for maybe a billionth of CO2 emissions. So I try to take that responsibility serious, even if China's not at the table. But I obviously hope China is there, and they have pledged quite strong levels of actual reduction. They're looking into renewables. So I'm even hopeful at the China front, let alone my individual level somewhat.
And just maybe stepping aside just from the topic of sustainability and COP in general, what does this say from a geopolitical perspective right now that we've seen in China not showing up in Rome and of course not in Glasgow?
The two absentees were actually China and Russia, two major emitters, Russia being a major producer of carbon energy sources. They themselves have pledged as countries to reduce their levels of emissions, that yes, but probably for a number of reasons, not just being climate policy, but also geopolitics overall. They're not at the summit. They don't take it as seriously. They're not as keen to shake hands with leaders of Western governments and so on. So there's immediately a geopolitical component. And I would argue, both from a Chinese and Russian perspective, it's also sometimes the accusation that all these goals about climate change, emission reduction and so on has a geopolitical component, for example, to weaken Russia as an energy producer. And it's very tricky if these two issues are conflated, because in a way you would think we're all in the same boat when it comes to climate change. But as soon as geopolitical factors come in, some people think they're in a different boat or they're being punished for different reasons. So the geopolitical angle is often neglected when we talk about purely climate issues, but very much plays into it. And that makes it all the way trickier.
Mm. Just maybe again, before we move on from this, Nina, you had a story that you picked up from the Sonntag Zeitung, which is maybe how consumers, of course, maybe square their relationship. Now, it's climate-based, but I mean, we can be talking about all kinds of also political issues, going back to China, you know, the issues of Uyghurs and of course, everything which is happening in the extreme west of China. How do we feel about that as well? And I'm not sure if the Sonntag Zeitung comes to some type of conclusion or it's simply a report.
Well, that would be the devastating part that I was talking about earlier. They did a representative poll. I don't know how many people they asked, but the question they posed was, are you willing to pay more for heating, flights, clothing and gas, if that additional price would help to stabilize the climate? And spoiler, people are not willing to do that. Actually, in all four areas, 81 to 93% of people said they are not willing to pay anything or just a little bit more. And it's mostly men, young men from non-urban areas, and young men from non-urban areas leaning towards right-wing politics that are not willing to do this.
And does this come as any surprise? And obviously, we should probably say this is not a global poll. This is a poll which is confined within the borders of Switzerland. Your read on that, let's not assume, but maybe for a moment, if we looked east to Austria, if we looked west to France, north to Germany, do you think the picture would be different outside of an urban context?
I'm not sure. I mean, the poll also says that women above the age of 65 in urban areas are most likely to pay more. I don't know. I think the poll just shows the limits of, as you said, individual responsibility.
Mm. And it's a theme that we've been picking up on because on one side it is, you can say, look, at if I have access to trams and if I live within an urban environment and maybe I don't have to go to a food processing plant at 4 o'clock in the morning, etc. You know, there are many things which, of course, you know, play to a vehicle. And also if I'm only making, I don't know, 50,000 francs a year or something. So is this type of poll helpful or is it just instructive, Benno?
I think it's awfully helpful, even though it's a sobering reality check, if you will. Sometimes we live in young urban bubbles and have a bit of a skewed picture of reality. As you say, this kind of reality that you described, Tyler, of someone with a low income who needs a car to go to work because there is no regular bus connection. Obviously, they feel at the end of the month the petrol bill way more. So increases through taxes or general commodity price hikes are really hurtful. So finding the right balance, but certain states and governments actually go quite far trying to redistribute certain things. So the people who do fly transatlantic 10 times a year for business or for leisure reasons, they pay a bit more and it's afterwards redistributed among the general population. And I think that's certainly one model that can help these people as well. But it's will be hard to communicate that as well because the debate is very much dominated by this leftist urban elite, if you will, and by the wealthy. So to make sure everyone is somewhat on board on small measures that everyone can actually digest is really key. And that's not that easy, particularly given these days our polarized political discourse.
Mm, it sounds like you're maybe creating a business plan for a new media model as well, which could possibly be part of a more interesting mix. It's just coming up to the bottom of the hour right now, coming up on Monocle on Sunday. We're going to be crossing to Bangkok shortly. We'll be talking to our Gwen Robinson there, our correspondent, of course, seeing what is going to be happening as the country starts to reopen and what that's, of course, going to mean for the tourism industry and many other sectors as well. Also coming up over the next 30 minutes as well. We're going to have, of course, Chandra Kurt's results, of course, four briefs that have been given to her about wines to be consumed. And also just after the news, we're going to be talking to Christoph Ament, of course, checking in to see what's in the German papers, also talking about his new little special that we headlined as well. But now over to London, Emma Nelson's there with the news.
Thank you very much indeed, Tyler. COP26, the UN Climate Change Summit begins later today in Glasgow. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the summit will be the world's moment of truth. Japan is holding a general election today. It's being seen as critical in providing Fumio Kishida, the country's new leader, with the public mandate he needs. Saudi Arabia has ordered Lebanon's ambassador to leave by the end of today over insulting comments by a Lebanese minister. The Gulf Kingdom has also imposed a blanket ban on all imports from Lebanon. And 45 bottles of vintage wine, some dating back more than 200 years and worth hundreds of thousands of euros, have been stolen from a Spanish restaurant. A couple checked into the hotel in Cáceres saying they were working for a private wine collector. Among the bottles taken was an 1806 Chateau d'Yquem, which was bought at auction for 12,000 euros in London, but was offered at the restaurant for a price of 350,000 euros. And that's your news on Monocle 24. Back to you in Zurich, Tyler.
Emma, did we have a tracker on Chandra? There's like these two people coming, showing up at this place. I don't know, just Chandra saying that she's over a hangover. What, Emma, what do you make of it?
Well, I don't want to suggest anything, but I would like to know what Chandra thinks of it.
Chandra, quickly.
Well, it hurts my heart, but you know, one thing, I hear that the sparkling wine in the UK gets cheaper, so this makes me happy. Now I get this news, I'm sad again. So no, it's awful, because it's, imagine how old this wine is and how, what a history he has behind, and now it gets stolen and maybe gets auctioned wrong, and it's, you know, you destroy somehow a piece of history, or they should protect the wine a little bit.
But
more.
This is an inside job. Someone knew what they were doing, clearly.
Yeah, I suppose. You know, 45 bottles is not, it's three cases, so it's, I don't know how they did it. So they filled the car and left? Or?
Okay, so Emma, here we go. Chandra drives a small Audi, so I think those three cases would fit in the back quite easily.
Tyler, we've had conversations on air when you've transported up to 75 bottles of wine in the back of your G-Wagon.
Yeah, but only within the Swiss border, never crossing it, Emma.
Okay.
We have to point that out.
No trips to Spain anytime soon.
But it's a trip to Germany right now. We're heading up to Berlin. Christoph Obmann, the editorial director of Zeit magazine, is standing by for us this morning. Guten Morgen, Christoph. Hello.
Hello, Tyler.
How are we this morning?
Very well. It's quite a sunny autumn day here in Berlin, and so Berliners are, you know, walking out and enjoying their walks around Schlachtensee Lake, I guess. So it's a really beautiful morning here.
Yeah, you paint a beautiful picture. It's similar here. I don't know if you heard also your friend Nina Kunz is also here this morning around the table.
I was very happy to listen to two columnists from our new Zeitmagazin Schweiz edition, Nina and Tyler. So I'm very happy to join the round.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe just to start by maybe telling us about it. Of course, the people who gathered a week before last, Christoph, we had a lovely little event that we did here at Duffelstrasse to, of course, celebrate the launch of this. And just for our listeners, this is it's going to be a twice yearly supplement to Zeit, to the main newspaper, but focusing on Switzerland. We're all amongst friends here. Was this a commercial play, or was it really sort of a sense that there was something editorially as well that you can bring to the market as Zeit magazine?
Well, you know, we launched Zeit Schweiz as a country's own edition at Zeit, at the paper, quite a few years ago, and circulation went up in Switzerland since then. You know, we thought, well, you know, if Zeit Schweiz as the paper product works so well, why don't we add some of what we can do from the magazine point of view, you know, talking about, you know, personal stories about people living in Switzerland, their own perspectives on their country. And so that's why we launched Zeitmagazin Schweiz. We've also launched different supplements within Germany, covering, for example, Frankfurt or Munich or Hamburg. I'm actually going to Frankfurt today to do an interview with what you might call Frankfurt's most famous son this evening, and the story will be published in Zeit Magazine Frankfurt at the end of the month. So it's part of a strategy for Zeit Magazine also to be part of the communication and the conversation in different areas, different cities, when it comes to Switzerland, of course, there's lots of different cities to be involved in. And Nina did a wonderful piece on Basel in Zeit Magazin Schweiz, the first issue that we published. So I'm very happy to become sort of more part of the conversation within Switzerland.
Don't keep our listeners in suspense when you talk about Frankfurt's sort of, well, I don't know, favorite son, but Frankfurt's son. Who are we talking about?
There is a DJ that some of you might know, and he's become this techno legend figure, Sven Feit, who grew up in Frankfurt and made his a world career as a techno and a DJ and music producer. And he actually, used the pandemic, of course, where he couldn't fly out to the world and play, to record his first album for 20 years. So I'll be talking with him tonight. And he's actually going to be playing tonight in Frankfurt at a club called Freud, which is a very, funny word for a new club. And so I'll be happy to meeting him again. Haven't seen him for quite a while. And this is going to be a story in Zeitmagazin Frankfurt.
And I'm keen to, obviously, here's someone who has not just a domestic following, but a European-wide following, a global following. Do you keep these, these interviews confined, Christoph, to just the Frankfurt supplement? Or, no matter where I am, am I also able to read this in the main magazine as well? Or does it find another life within the newsletters, as podcasts? Does it trickle out into the wider Zeit world?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the great thing about the digital world in the media landscape, of course, is that everything that we published regionally or locally is also part of the Zeit app. So if you subscribe to Zeit digitally, you'll get all these local stories as well. And obviously, we are also publishing every story that is being produced and edited for the local issues digitally. So, for example, your new column for Zeitmagazin Schweiz, where you talk about the international aspects of Switzerland, has also been published digitally, so it goes out into the world and everyone can read it as well.
When we look ahead, this obviously you want to keep these in a German speaking context as well, but at the same time, you see some German newspapers or some German media houses also looking how do they expand beyond their borders, and of course that means diversifying their portfolios a little bit. I mean, you could look in Switzerland, even though they've not bought papers, but down the street, NZZ, their investors in Arcatonic right now. They're now owners of Arc Daily, of course, in two very respected architecture and design portals or websites. Do you see as well, of course, 80 million in Germany plus the greater DACH region is one nice market, but at the same time, there's an English language edition of what you're doing. Do you see yourselves potentially pushing the brand even further into other languages, or if not just English?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, we're thinking about possibilities, to do that all the time. I think you have to be very careful and not to sort of overestimate your own status. I mean, within the DACH region, of course, Die Zeit is probably one of the big media brands today. And our circulation is at an all-time high now, which is also a bit of a crazy phenomenon, I guess. But you have to find a very smart way of, I think, publishing what you do in different languages. But technology is moving forward so quickly. So we're actually thinking about, publishing part of what we do in different languages. I think you need to find a very smart way. I mean, you found a smart way with what you do. But also, if we're talking about Swiss International, there might be a way of actually talking about what we do, but the aspect of the international power of Switzerland, the culture within Switzerland in new ways, maybe also in audio. Who knows what the future will bring?
Indeed. And I know you have to catch a train. I've got very strict notes here. Christoph, train to catch at 10:40, or at least to leave at 10:40. So it gives us exactly 1 minute. I'm looking at the back of Nina Kunz's book, Ich denke zu viel. And there is, of course, a little endorsement by you. You say, diese Texte machen süchtig. Just quickly, your take on Nina's book.
Well, I think if you want to know what sort of a young intellectual from Europe thinks about the world today and about the influences of technology towards her generation, I think you should definitely pick up a copy of Ich denke zu viel.
Very good. Christoph, always good to talk to you. Go and catch that ICE down to Frankfurt, and we'll be chatting to you very soon.
See you soon in Zurich.
Thanks very much. That was Christoph Ahmed, editorial director of Zeit magazine. Nina, so Christoph, I feel he sort of set you up a little bit because he said in the Neue Schweizer Ausgabe that you did a story on Basel. Here we are sitting and standing actually in Zurich. I think a lot of people who might be listening, they understand the power of brand Basel because of the art fair, because of pharma, because of maybe one or two, probably one big design company that's based there as well. Maybe sort of idiot's guide on a Sunday morning, compare and contrast for us quite quickly. How is Basel different from Zurich?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say ah at Christoph Ahmed. I'm so grateful for these words. That's so nice. And then I find it really hard to generalize, obviously. And I was kind of afraid I would never be able to go back to Basel after writing this piece. But I think that Basel is just more laid back, and I visited the city so often now also to write this piece. And for example, in Zurich, I often feel underdressed, even though I make an effort, and in Basel, I never do. And on a Sunday morning in Zurich, I think the big difference is kind of the lake, because it's just kind of grand. And in Basel, everything seems to be smaller and the distances are not that far. So, yeah, I think that's the main point. It's more laid back.
But then on the flip side, you also hear, and this is maybe from outsiders who are working for big pharma companies, etc. People also say the city is very hard to crack. That I always hear about a Basel mentality, people coming into the city, that it is quite closed. And I don't know if that is true, or maybe just people are so laid back, they're just not interested.
And that's really interesting, because I think I'd say the same thing about Zurich. My partner is from Germany, and he wasn't invited to kind of a dinner party, not by expats in Zurich, for I think 5 years before I think people kind of started to invite him. And I think, I mean, I grew up in Zurich. And
were you a couple at this time? You were invited, he wasn't invited? This sounds very extreme.
Yeah, no, I think, I grew up in Zurich. I lived here for 30 years, which is a very long time. And I think the problem is, I know people from, like kindergarten, high school, the drama group I was in at 13, university, it's just there's so many people. And I have like very little time to meet all the people that I met in the past 3 decades. And I think people just have a problem with time management when they grow up here. And it's not that they don't want to get to know anyone, it's just they don't have the time. That's just don't you agree?
Well, I think it's also the issue, time management is difficult because this is like the world's biggest village too. So also you just bump into people constantly. So as much as you want to be there on time, you see someone, at the tram stop, and then you see someone on the tram, and then someone honks and waves at you. It's complicated.
Like you can't get, buy like some tomatoes without bumping into an ex here. It's impossible.
John, listen, we probably need an extra voice. You seem to be in Basel quite a bit. Your take, and how do you contrast the two cities?
Well, I got a little bit acquainted with Basel during the pandemic because we couldn't travel, so I was tired to cook all the time, so I thought we have to go to a hotel, and then there's this nice Hotel Kraft in Basel, and so it became our office, and I started to walk and see the city. For me, what you feel there is absolutely, it's a border city. You can feel that there are two countries to each side. It's a more modest city. Yes, maybe you don't get into the families, but it's more modest. Zurich is much more, you have to show off, you have to tell who you are. And Basel is modest, it's also more scientific people because of the pharma industry. So actually, I felt very comfortable to be there. I felt not so threatened like sometimes in Zurich.
Mm. Okay, final word to you on this, Benno.
But just to conclude that discussion, it's actually quite nice that we don't buy into that weird rivalry between the two cities that very much exists, that in which many other countries have equivalents of that. But certainly Basel and Zurich, which are also, by the way, very distinguishable by their accent, by the dialect of Swiss German that the two cities speak. But the two have their upsides. And I very much agree with that take, that Basel is probably a bit more of the laid-back version of Zurich. Maybe it's because the Rhine, the river there, is so massive and flows so slowly that it makes people a bit more relaxed than in busy Zurich, always trying to be super businesslike. So I like both for their very respective qualities.
Very diplomatic of you. We are going to cross over to Bangkok now. Our Gwen Robinson is there. Of course, this is Gwen. Good afternoon, by the way.
Sawadee ka, Tyler.
Sawadee ka to you, Gwen. Listen, we've seen so much news now over the last, I would say, probably 2 weeks. Already, there's been images of massive Zoom meetings that seem to pull in every region of Thailand with various people with epaulets and medals on from the military, of course, talking about this great grand reopening. November 1st seems to be upon us. Are people going to be flooding in? What? And again, I guess we should probably frame this by saying there's been a lot of mixed messages as well. So bring us up to speed with what's happening, Gwen.
Well, as best I can, because as you said, I mean, I think it's gotten to the stage where I think a lot of people in Thailand and people outside who want to come in don't believe anything until it actually happens. But we have all been told, and of course, it was only finally announced as decided on Friday. So apparently from tomorrow, we've got a whole new regime that is welcoming international travelers, but only those from an approved list of 45 countries and plus Hong Kong. If they are fully vaccinated, they can come in with no quarantine, no restrictions, except that there are always catches. They will have to stay in a hotel and have a COVID PCR test on arrival and wait for the all clear. So that's number one, and that's caused a huge sigh of relief to a lot of people in those countries. There's different rules for different countries. If you're fully vaccinated but you're not on the list of 46 fully approved ones, you can still come in through this Phuket sandbox scheme, which has been quite successful. And then finally, those who have not been vaxxed can still come in, but they have a whole lot of other restrictions to contend with. But on top of all this, the great news, I think, for a lot of people in the main areas of Thailand is the lifting finally of a curfew that has been in place for many months, and finally allowing alcohol sales in restaurants and possibly bars. So that appears to be a big grand reopening that, as you say, all the men in green with epaulettes and also tourism industry officials are touting hugely. And we will see how it all goes from tomorrow.
So Gwen, just tell me one was to venture out into Bangkok then next week, and this means really, almost life as normal. Does this mean also that street vendors, of course, the markets, all of this returns as well? It will look like Bangkok as we knew it 2 years ago.
Well, I can tell you, I'm at a cafe in a very nice street in Bangkok, Soi Lang Suan, and there's a very hip weekend street market that sprung up last few weekends. Everyone wearing masks, of course, but that kind of street life is coming back. The food vendors are back, you can see, but everyone with masks, and there's temperature taking machinery equipment everywhere you walk in and out. The Thai government did at one point scare everyone by insisting that only fully vaccinated people would be allowed to even go in a restaurant. But maybe you can try that in a country in Europe where, it's nearly 100% vaccination. But here, unfortunately, Thailand has really barely reached the 40% limit mark of fully vaccinated. And in fact, claims by some local officials that everyone in Bangkok has had at least one shot, and at least 75% of people have been fully vaccinated in Bangkok. I would venture not true. There, you can talk to a lot of people who have not been vaccinated in Bangkok, but it does seem most of the people have been. So those kind of restrictions do remain, and I think that will temper the grand reopening. And like everything in Thailand, I can't see the floodgates opening and people from those 46 countries just sailing in. There still will be quite a bit of bureaucracy, and there still is a lot of forms to fill out and at least one or two tests to take.
Mm. Gwen, if we look across the broader region, ASEAN and even beyond, so, look, if we go up to Korea, we've heard the government there saying that November is going to mark sort of the month of really being living with COVID. That here in Korea, they want to gradually lift measures. So by the time we get, you know, just beyond Christmas, it will pretty much be business as usual. And we've heard similar murmurings from elsewhere. Big question mark over Japan. But if you look at this, I guess, from both a, from an economic perspective, but also from a geopolitical perspective as well, do you think that almost maybe November 1st, it throws down the gauntlet a little bit, that this race, really starts and we do see a proper reopening on the part of Asia?
Well, that is such a good point, because there is, and particularly in Thailand, where, and I think right through Asia, Asian people tend to be, you can just see it, far more cautious than Westerners to watch. I mean, a lot of my Asian friends have been watching in marvel at how people have ripped off masks in the UK or elsewhere, and the images you see on TV. I mean, there's still a great deal of caution here. So I think that there will be a mixed embrace of this reopening. It should be said, there's actually quite a bit of opposition in Thailand. There's arguments that it's too early, and that is being reflected, I think, in other parts of the region. There was a big ASEAN summit this week, and tourism was discussed. PM Prayut of Thailand was one of the ones urging his fellow ASEAN leaders to really consider getting their act together on tourism. They also want to get more regional cooperation to facilitate the flow of flights and visitors. But as you point out, there's a very mixed feeling. A lot of eyes are on Japan. Of course, Japan is one of the favorite destinations for Thais. So there's a lot of Thais themselves who'd love to get to Japan. And I think there's a feeling that after the election in Japan that's today, there may be an announcement about that. But I think in Thailand, also to remember, this country is still racking up 8,000 to 10,000cases a day, even now. And while that might, infection rates might be high in Europe, you've got a nearly fully vaccinated population. In Thailand, you haven't. So I think that's also fueling some pushback, particularly from the medical establishment. But let's just say this country is about to fall off a cliff. The economic figures are terrible, and they've just lowered further the growth forecast for this year. And I think it really was a moment of truth for the government and also industry, because hotels have been collapsing, small businesses have been closing, and I think they really feel that if it doesn't happen November 1, then forget it. I mean, this is the Christmas period coming up. People are making plans. I think a lot of people, foreigners, visitors, want to get back to a nice tropical beach holiday, and I think that's why the Thais are moving very quickly now. And you can see this happening in Malaysia and even Bali, which has tried this reopening, not to a great deal of success, I gather.
Gwen, just quickly before we go, on a rather lighter note, but a moment of conflict as well. I missed it, but there's an interesting story about Miss Universe Thailand and of course, some issues about, perception and certainly perceptions when it comes to one's figure and body weight. Tell us about how this story has played out since the crowning happened.
Well, indeed, I actually have to confess I missed it too, because I'm not a great follower of these beauty contests, but they're big in Thailand and also right through the region. Miss Universe Thailand was crowned last Sunday, October 25th, and to the surprise, amazement, and also horror, it seems, of a lot of Thais, she is a Thai-Australian model who could only be described as Amazonian and very curvaceous and stunning looking by any measure. But what has happened is an incredible firestorm of criticism on the Twitter sphere and like other social media, fuming away about how she's chubby or even like fat, and how dare they pick someone like that to represent Thailand. It really has highlighted some attitudes that underline a quite a narcissistic culture in Thailand, which really promotes these paper-thin models and a selfie-obsessed culture, really. And she has, her name is Anjali Scott Kemmis. She's hit back saying that she actually is proud of her body shape and aims to represent women of all shapes and sizes. throughout this competition. And the final Miss Universe is held, I think it will be held in Israel in December. So we shall see if she's proven right. But adding to the Thai shock is that the runner-up was a Thai African model. So we've got a Thai Australian as the number one and Thai African as a second. So I think that's also a reality check for Thais who tend to prefer, you know, value Thai-ness. And they also feel that Miss Universe Thailand this year may not be Thai enough for them.
Interesting, Gwen. If you're looking for a special gig, maybe we can send you off to Israel to be our special correspondent at Miss Universe 2022. Our Gwen Robinson in Bangkok, thanks very much for that. Very quickly, before we race to the end of the show, maybe we'll head over to London. Andrew is standing by, because Andrew Chandra, as we'll recall at the top of the show, he's looking for a grand wine. Andrew, are you looking for a sustainable wine as well to celebrate COP in Glasgow in grand style? I forget how pointy the brief was.
Well, I guess in the end, no wine is very sustainable around me. It's all going to get drunk at some point. So its reserves will be diminished. But yes, I was looking for something that might be suitable to serve as a gesture, well, perhaps more than a gesture, as a hint that you can do things better.
Well, because you thought about something big, I think about big wine families, because they have a lot of responsibility. And there's Miguel Torres, for example, that does a lot for environmental, for the planet and for saving. But there's another family, the Lagader family in North Italy, and they just launched a new project, which is called Terra Alpina. And they partner together with wine growing colleagues in the Dolomites, and they do biodynamic or sustainable healthy wine, red and white. So you can use it for the whole Congress, even for how many, 10,000 guests, there is enough wine.
Andrew, hope that fills the bill for you.
Thank you very much, John.
Benno, remind us, there's something about a ratatouille and empty shelves. I forget. I got lost.
A very simple vegetable heavy Sunday evening meal, and well, yeah, ideally sad wine. I have different varieties already in my shelf.
Well, the problem is that you tricked me. I don't know what you have at home.
Of course. But
I thought, you know, Ratatouille origin is Provence, south of France. There's a very good, nice area for wines. You find a lot of south France wines, Languedoc wine. One of my favorite is from the Domaine Lortus. It's a Syrah. It's spicy like the Ratatouille should be. You can eat meat in the Ratatouille or not, and the wine will work very well.
Noted.
And can he buy it on a Sunday if he heads to the Hauptbahnhof?
Yes, Coop in the Coop.
Okay, very good. Nina, remind us what there was something about. All I recall is that it just was a big budget because of the way the book is doing. So
yeah, and all the requests were so fancy. Mine was so stupid, because I think I said no headache and dry.
There's no stupid question, only a stupid answer, like my teacher once used to say.
Okay.
No, it's very. It was not clear for me if you wanted red or white. You just said dry, so I went now for red. And I thought, if I think big, I think about Dürrenmatt, our famous writer in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. He used to drink a lot of wine. And one of his famous Bordeaux Saint-Emilion was the Chateau Ville-Maurie. It inspired him a lot. And I think wine drinking should, of course, not give headache, but should always inspire you.
Okay, Emma, standing by very quickly. Chandra, in less than 15 seconds. Emma, what did you want?
I wanted something to eat with processed end of pumpkin, and something to, a little pick-me-up in a hip flask, please.
You made me all spiritual, because I go to the second one for the flask. You know, with pumpkin, you take always apricot in this. How do you say schnapps in English? Schnapps.
And it's
then
schnapps.
And you can hide it, and it smells good, like this apricot in taste. And for the pumpkin, you take a creamy, round wine. And because I thought about the family when I thought about you, as the Sadi family from South Africa, they do a wonderful Chenin Blanc, and this will fit perfectly.
Thank
Emma,
you,
work
Chandra.
For you?
Absolutely. I like the idea that it has to be secretive as well. I quite like it.
Excellent. Chandra Kurt, Nina Kunz, Benno Zog, Andrew Tuck, and Emma Nelson, thanks very much for joining us today. Also, thanks to Christoph Amon and Gwen Robinson, our producers, Emma Nelson, Marcus Hippie, and Desiree Bentley in London, Christy Evans also looking after us. I'm Tyler Brulé. I'm back next week. Have a very good Sunday.